Cation laser touching his skull, Jack remembered something of Cormac's almost instinctive reasoning. Afrin was an unknown, and as such could be dangerous to more than himself. And in his present situation, it would be foolish for him to destroy potential weapons. He needed every edge he could get. "Hide yourself and observe," he told her. A user had been employed in the system. That was certain, because he had set his grid link searching for local USpace information traffic to key into, and found nothing all night. As for radio, or any of the other radiations the hardware in his head could receive or transmit, he was getting little return there either. From the city, there came the perpetual murmur of something indecipherable, wavering randomly across various frequencies, and Cormac supposed the people here must be experimenting with primitive radio. He was getting a beacon return from the Jack Ketch at longer and longer intervals, which meant the ship was departing the planet and could not or would not reply. He had also briefly received beacon returns from the two other ships Jack had warned of, and did not try to contact them. "We have no backup," Gant observed from the lander. "Perhaps we should pull out until we find out what's going on." Gant had also been unable to get any response during the night. There had been none, even from Fethan and Cento, and Cormac wondered if they were dead, or just staying low profile because of some sort of danger up there. In morning twilight, with two Metallia guards nervously leading the way, Cormac headed towards the roadhouse. Kilnsman Astia had instructed both men to do exactly as Cormac asked, and no longer be so trigger-happy. They now both carried their weapons slung and with the safeties on, and seemed disinclined to disobey Astia's order, probably because they had faced an unkillable man who, underneath his skin, seemed to be made of metal, and witnessed how dangerous was the weapon at Cormac's wrist, but also because their kilnsman had been returned to them, miraculously alive. One of the two accompanying guards kept checking his own right hand and flexing fingers that, the previous day, had been lying severed in the sand. It had been a very minor task for the auto-dock aboard the lander, but Cormac understood how something like that impressed less advanced cultures. To Gant, Cormac sent, "We'll assess the situation here and do just that. Catching Skellor has always been problematic, like hunting in a woodpile for a poisonous snake." "With a blindfold on," Gant reminded. "Yes, his chameleon wear." Cormac didn't really need that reminder. He was starting to get edgy now. He didn't know enough about what had happened, and with the vital resource of the Jack Ketch and that ship's telefactors unavailable, could only judge things by what he learned here on the ground. He had set his gridlink to try and crack the encryption Jack used in his signal to his factors, but there was no guarantee of success or that the telefactors would become available again any time soon. As the two men led him up the stairs to the roadhouse, Cormac considered what he had learned both last evening and this morning. Astia and the man who had lost his fingers had been endlessly curious, hungry for knowledge, an inculcated Metallia trait, it would appear. But while Cormac regularly answered their questions, he also probed and learned much. The Metallias were standard format humans, and must have been descendants of the colony ship's crew. Others here were dapped colonists, and a small number was a mixture of both, mostly Mineraliers who lived in both Metallia and colonist domains. This lack of interbreeding, Cormac soon discovered, was the result of opinions of racial superiority on both sides. The colonists rightly considered themselves superior because they were hardier, though it amused Cormac to discover they thought they were purebred humans. Interestingly, it was the Metalliers' physical inferiority that had led them to evolve a more technical society, not their vaunted mental superiority. However, Cormac was surprised to learn that the prevalence of weapons here was not the result of interracial conflict, but because conditions, until recent technical advances made by the Metalliers, had been very harsh. And the present, apparent militarism was a direct result of orders from Chief Metallier Tanaquil. Someone had warned that personage about Skellor, and Cormac really wanted to know who. But right now he needed to talk to someone who might have actually seen Skellor. Mineraliers Chandel and Dornick? The two awaited him at a table in the Roadhouse refectory. He noticed that the man, Dornick, was a full dapt, while the woman, Chandel, showed only a hint of genetic adaptation, whenever she blinked down nictitating membranes. The male seemed about to blurt something out, but the woman rested a hand on his arm to silence him and asked, "And you are?" "Ian Cormac." Just as if saying his own name provided some sort of key, he felt something slide into place in his head, almost with the sound and feel of a piece of a 3D puzzle fashioned out of lead blocks. A communication channel opened, and he felt great relief, but only momentarily. It was not Jack. Cormac was now in contact with the telefactor earlier sent to Dragon's supposed location. In doubled vision, he now observed two of the strange mounts these people used, bolting riderless along the edge of the Hardfield wall. He would have to come back to that, however, as the woman was now staring at him, awaiting some reply. Diverting to storage the information he was receiving from the factor's sensors, he then replayed the last few seconds recorded in his gridlink. "A strange name, and a very brief answer to my question," the woman had said, gesturing to the window and towards the lander outside. "I am from what is called the Polity, and am here hunting the same person as these fellows," Cormac indicated the two guards. "You're a policeman from Earth?" she said. "Yes." "Damn!" A second signal keyed in from a telefactor lying tilted on a mountain slope. Even though the machine was half blinded, Cormac still saw a vision of hell. Molten rock and glowing embers, fires consuming seared vegetation in a deep valley and throwing up columns of black smoke. Then a third signal keyed in from one high in the air over endless desert, and a fourth from a factor slowly tracking through tumbled stone ruins. He shunted all they were sending to storage and awaited the fifth signal from the telefactor investigating the nearby city, but it stubbornly refused to come. He returned his attention to the woman, who sat there seemingly at a loss as to how to continue after his affirmation. He inquired, "Kilnsman Astia questioned you about any unusual people you might have seen. You said you did see someone, but were apparently reticent about exactly what you saw. Could you describe this individual to me?" "I'm not even sure he was real. Things I saw. But now..." She gestured towards the window again. "Tell me it all," said Cormac. "Leave nothing out, and be assured there's not much I won't believe." Chandel then told him about her encounter with a man who could make himself invisible, what he said, how he looked, when it occurred. As she went on to talk about the explosions in the sand towers, he held up his hand. "I know about that. Can you tell me any more about this man?" She shook her head. "He just disappeared, heading towards the city." As Cormac stood from the table, Chandel asked, "What is he? Something horrible, Cormac replied, heading towards the city. As he left the roadhouse, Cormac looked up as a shadow drew across him and observed the first of two blimps descending between him and the lander. He picked up his pace, speculating that the blimps had to be hydrogen-filled, as he doubted they possessed the technical capacity here to refine that quantity of helium. In his gridlink, he skimmed an overview of that sort of primitive technology and discovered he was right. Drawing closer, he saw the armed metalliers stepping out of the suspended cabin, noted their raggedy look and the objects clinging behind their ears. Idiot. It was like a slap to him when he recollected exactly why his gridlink had been deactivated not so many years ago. It interfered with his functioning as an agent of Earth Central, crippled his humanity and his ability to assess human situations. And, like an addict coming back to his favourite drug, he had taken to it again, oh, so quickly, and had so quickly forgotten. The telefactor at the city was not functioning. Skellor had gone there, a man more ruthless than any AI, and possessing a technology capable of turning people into mere extensions of himself. Cormac broke into a run, circling the figures now disembarking from the balloon's cabin and flinging Shuriken up as a guard between himself and them. Gant, he's here, he sent to the golem. Gant was into the lander and then out again in a flash, a pulse rifle up and aimed. Weapons fire slammed into him, knocking him back, staggering. He returned fire, killing several metalliers running towards him. Of those coming towards Cormac, one spun round, his body cut cleanly in half at the waist, and another toppled with his head separating on a fountain of blood. Shuriken was whickering in sharp mechanical delight. The other blimp was drawing overhead, and Cormac ran in its shadow. He reached inside his coat and drew his thin gun, for its shots burned, whereas Shuriken only cut. Suddenly, a cloud of light erupted, washing heat across him, flinging people along the ground. Gant had acted on the idea before Cormac did, and the first balloon was now explosively on fire. Shielding his face, Cormac reached the lander and ducked through the door. He recalled Shuriken, and it flashed inside to thrum above him, just before Gant too dived through the door. Cormac palmed the lock plate as Gant leapt into the pilot's chair. Get us out of here! The lander began to rise, tilting to miss the second blimp. Cormac ignored the sound of small arms fire because it could cause no damage, but he felt a sinking sensation when something heavy hit the hull. We've got a passenger, observed Gant leadenly. 10 of the 12 landers departed Egidian, the remaining two being unable to break away from the frozen docking clamps. Fethan shaded his eyes, more out of long-acquired habit than from any need to protect them, just as a second lander detonated far ahead and to his right. Clinically, he then observed the remains of an iron drive nacelle go gyrating past and listened to the patter of other debris against the hull.
Cento? He queried.
It had been the golem's idea that they go down in separate landers, so spreading the odds that one of them might reach the surface intact and survive to tell the tale.
No, I wasn't in that one, the golem replied over their internal radio link. They could not use the ship-to-ship communicators because that would have alerted Skellor to their presence. Just as, much to Fethan's chagrin, neither of them could interfere with the lander's automatic systems to make corrections. Though if it was a choice between that and dying in a conflagration because the vessel hit atmosphere at the wrong angle, then interfere he would.
Any clue where we're going to put down? He asked.
Too far out to calculate vectors, but I'd guess the target is that city, and that, once we're close enough, a landing program will cut in and bring us down in the flatlands right before it. Certainly, no auto program would attempt a landing in the terrain lying behind it. If those programs work.
Fethan sat back, feeling the perished synthetic padding of the seat cracking and breaking as he shifted against the frayed strap holding him in place, and wondered what they would do once they did reach the surface. Maybe by bearding Skellor up here, Fethan and Cento would have been risking their lives pointlessly. But merely surviving to tell ECS what had occurred here, Fethan did not like either. Maybe he was mostly ceramo plastics and metals, but that did not make him just a damned recording machine. He thought then about the other, even larger battles. Ships, ECS ships, had entered the system, employed a user, then proceeded to attack the Jack Ketch. Instinctively, he felt that these attacking ships had to be renegades, but he could not even be sure of that. Maybe Jack had somehow stepped over the line and ECS had sent these ships to destroy him. Fethan suspected the chances of actually arresting a warship were remote. Whatever, that was a conflict completely beyond his own capabilities, one in which the ships would employ moon-fragmenting and AI mind-bending weapons in some huge lethal ballet where nanosecond decisions vitally counted. Down on the surface, there was perhaps some other conflict in the offing. Skellor was probably still in the city, operating the message laser, and Cormac was almost certainly closing in on him. The agent needed to know everything Fethan now knew.
"We'll have to go into the city to see if we can link up with Cormac and Gant. Maybe we'll be able to deal with Skellor before it comes to the kill program back at the ship springing its trap."
"Perhaps it would be better to pull back and let Skellor come."
The interference to Cento's signal, as much as the actual words, told Fethan he had been duped.
"You're still aboard Egygian, aren't you?" he said.
More distant now, Cento replied, "My feelings are all emulation, but still I feel the need for vengeance. Skellor must pay for Aiden. Our and
S who
burnt them. Them all. No. Be so cruel."
"What are you talking about?"
Cento spoke more, but Fethan understood none of it, as the transmission now broke up completely. The thing about watching watchers, Vulture felt, was that no one had invented a greater exercise in futility. She was bored out of her avian skull and beginning to do the most ridiculous things to keep herself entertained, baiting sleer nymphs out from under the rubble pile located on the opposite side of the outcrop to where the telefactor rested had not been the brightest idea, but at least she had only lost a few feathers. The current game was one recalled from her inception memory banks and was another pointless exercise, almost zen-like in its futility. Having drawn out the grid on the flat surface of the slab, using a piece of natural chalk with an attractive greenish tint deriving from local copper compounds, Vulture picked up a pebble in her beak, tossed it ahead of her, and proceeded with her game of hopscotch. Within a few minutes, she was wondering about making the whole thing more interesting by using a sleer nymph rather than a stone. It was then that a shadow drew across her.
"If your tunnels extend all the way out here," she grumbled, "then why am I out here watching that lump of fucking scrap? One of your pseudopods could have done it as easily."
The dragon head above was not very forthcoming. It tilted for a moment
to inspect the hopscotch grid before returning its attention to Vulture.
You like games?
The alternative was twiddling my thumbs.
Vulture stretched out her wings and gave a loose-jointed shrug.
I have a new game for you to play. Win it, and you die. Lose it, and someone else begins to live.
Oh, it's all just plus points for me, then,
said the ex-ship's AI acerbically.
Do what I want, and I will consider all debts repaid, and you will then be free.
Vulture wondered for the nth time about just flying away, but was not so stupid as to be fooled by her apparent freedom. No doubt there was some sneaky little program sitting inside her, ready to press in the point of a dagger when she did not choose to cooperate.
How about if I say, screw you? She asked, just to be sure.
Dragon tilted this one head, milky saliva dripping from one side of its mouth.
Then I take back the flesh you have borrowed, even though it has no thumbs.
Okay.
Vulture hopped back along the length of her grid. One talon, two talons, then a beat of her wings to carry her up on top of the rock she frequented in order to check that the telefactor had not moved.
Tell me about it!
Dragon described a game, a kind of three-dimensional chess and Rubik's Cube all in one, and how Vulture must play it. The description came across in no human language or machine code previously known to Vulture, but she understood it, was fascinated, and a little horrified by what it all implied for an AI like herself. It meant there was a hell for her kind.
But why? Vulture eventually asked. Why not just destroy the damned machine?
Because I can,
Dragon replied cryptically. Cormac held up his arm and, with merely thought, recalled Shuriken to its holster. Okay. He'd found the snake in the woodpile. Now the trick was to pull its fangs without it biting him, blindfolded. Set it on auto, the direction we're going. Gant did as instructed, then scrambled from his seat. Cormac stepped over to a plastic box secured along one wall and opened it. Inside, neatly packed, was equipment he might need. He quickly found two APW carbines and tossed one to Gant. Narrow focus, and try not to hit anything that's keeping us in the air. Gant adjusted the weapon accordingly and peered at the ceiling. Cormac placed his own carbine at his feet and from the box removed a smaller, brushed aluminium case. He opened that to reveal the three innocuous-looking cylinders of CTDs. Taking one out, he studied its detonator, a programming mini-console and a single touchpad. Pressing his thumb against the pad, he got ribonucleic coding on a little screen. Then accepted, and the mini-console activated. Just then, violet light ignited inside the landers as Gant punched holes through the ceiling where silvery filaments were growing in the metal. The lander filled with smoke and with flares of disintegrating metal. Cormac dredged calm from deep inside himself. Setting the CTD for timed detonation, he gave it 1 minute, and shoved it under a folded environment suit. He then took out two AG harnesses. Here, put it on. He tossed one harness to Gant, then took up a carbine. Just then came the whoomph of the door seals disengaging. Instead of using the carbine, Cormac drew his thin gun and fired at the locking mechanism, turning delicate components into a bubbling mess. Then, on narrow focus, he used the carbine to punch holes randomly around the door.
"Now that's not fair," came a familiar voice from the comm console.
"He's into the system," Cormac sent to Gant. "Get your harness on," Gant sent back. Cormac quickly obliged. Something was now worming through the holes in the roof, a woody member jointed like an insect's leg. As he again took up his carbine, Cormac saw something else scuttle for cover across the floor. "Spin us and blow the front screen." Gant stepped into the cockpit and hit the requisite controls. Cormac grabbed a nearby handle and hung on. With a roar of engines, the horizon began to slip to the left. G-forces dragged him sideways, his feet coming off the deck, then swung him towards the screen. Violet fire lit up the inside of the lander, and the screen departed in a dusty cloud with a huge sucking inhalation. He released his hold and tumbled through the air.
"Tricky fucker, aren't you?"
said Skellor over Cormac's gridlink as the agent manipulated the controls of his AG harness.
"Go fuck yourself, Skellor."
In a moment he had stabilized himself and could see the lander still heading away. He turned in midair, trying to locate Gant, then saw him far below, still falling.
"Gant, what are you playing at?"
"Not working,"
came the dead soldier's reply. Cormac watched him plummet, strike the edge of a butte, and tumble down in a shower of rubble into a canyon. The horizon then ignited like a flashbulb, and Cormac began a rapid descent himself, knowing what was coming. 20 meters from his landing, the wind slammed across and tossed him cartwheeling through air filled with stinging grit. Slowly regaining control, he ran with the wind until he could safely descend into a canyon, and there, in the shelter of a tilted sandstone slab, he awaited the passing of the brief storm. Later, he was glad to see Gant stomping towards him, though dismayed to see how much of the dead soldier's synth flesh had been ripped away. But that was a small price to pay.
"We got him," said Cormac, standing up.
Gant slapped Cormac's weapon away, grabbed him by the throat, and hoisted him up off the ground.
"Guess again, shithead."
The Titanic Jerusalem dropped into U-space with a flickering, grinding disturbance of reality, as if a smaller ship was just acceptable, but this was going too far. In void that was hostile to tender, organic, linear minds, and which drove their possessors to extremities, like plucking out offending eyes, and when discovering that didn't work, groping for some implement to dig deeper, the great ship accelerated beyond human calculation. Jerusalem itself, a mind, using quantum computing and functioning in ways that defied evolutionary logic, looked upon this immutable infinity and considered it good and home. However, the AI realized it would shortly be in for a rough ride. In 3D translation, the view ahead was one of a roiling grey sun, averted from the surrounding greyness like some huge tumour. It could appear as small as Jerusalem willed it, for here the AI had to apply dimension, not measure it. However, the sphere was 200 light-years across in real space, and no amount of logic juggling was going to put Jerusalem at the centre of it anywhere. What was required was unalloyed brute force. Most polity ships just could not penetrate the maelstrom created by a user. But then, most ships possess 3 or 4 fusion reactors and a minimum requirement of U-space engines and hard fields that could be powered up, with replacements in storage. Jerusalem put
all 800 of the ship's reactors online to provide vast amounts of energy to stabilize phased layers of U-Space engines in its hull and reinforce its scaling of hard fields. In time, and in no time, it hit the user sphere of interference like a bullet hitting an apple. But this was one very large apple. Pocketing his toys, Mr. Crane stood up and then, almost guiltily, scrubbed out the 18-square grid with his boot. The large bird, which had taken off from a distant outcrop and was now hovering overhead, would not normally have attracted his attention. But his journey had shown this to be a world where the fauna barely got above ground, let alone into the air. But that was not what brought him to his feet. He could sense a change in the static electricity levels in the air, and now a figure was walking towards him on the other side of the barrier. Then the way was open. The force field disappeared with the faintest of pops, as of a bubble burst, its meniscus breaking into a million silver leaves, dispersing on the air. The figure turned out to be a woman, who glanced at him curiously as he strode on through. He ignored her. She wasn't Dragon, and though her presence here had something to do with the sudden collapse of the field, she did not appear to be one of that entity's creations.
"I'm here to show you the way," someone said.
Crane glanced sideways, expecting to see the woman coming after him. The bird passed close overhead, and in a cloud of dust and a couple of detached feathers, landed just in front of Crane.
"Over there,"
the bird gesturing with one wing.
"That's where you go."
Crane just stared. The bird continued,
"I'm Dragon's envoy, and through me, that entity has a message for you."
Crane stared at it harder.
"You ever played chess?" Vulture asked.
Chapter 20. Avatars. The first AIs communicated with their human masters by voice, document, and VR packages, representing themselves in whatever form those masters chose. Certainly in those years before the Quiet War, they themselves showed no initiative in this respect, probably so as not to alarm the dumb humans. As soon as the war began, AIs started to appear in those VR packages as robed figures, angels, devils, historical characters and mythic monsters, as well as other shapes and forms, esoteric and strange. They also revealed their faces on screen and materialized in the laser space of early holojectors. Time passed, technology improved, and AIs became our rulers. Floating holojectors made possible walking holograms, AI avatars. AIs also used all manner of golem, android, and robot for this purpose, and use them still. Baroque automatons came briefly into vogue, then went out again, style of avatar body being subject to whimsical AI fashion. Many of the more powerful AIs can now run whole armies of avatars, projected, real, or by blows of both. Also, what is an avatar and what is a distinct entity is a matter of much debate. Now it is rumoured that those same powerful AIs are using cloned and genetically manipulated creatures and even humans as avatars. This is doubtless true and further blurs the line between distinct entities and yet further makes a nightmare of definition. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Turgle
gazed blearily up at the patch of light, trying to understand what it meant. Abruptly he realized he was seeing the light of dawn, and, though he had felt certain he would never fall asleep on the cold metal floor so long as a monster prowled around outside, he evidently had dropped off. Anderson's snores, vibrating their prison through much of the hours of darkness, attested to the fact that he had certainly slept. Turgle stood, stretched, and looked around him. 5 coffin shapes had been inset in the curved wall to his left.
What is this place? A morgue?
For a moment, Anderson's snores stuttered out of sequence, before falling back into their familiar rhythm. Turgle frowned at him, then moved over to the hole the knight had created to get them in here. He peered out. No sign of the Droon. Just a damp morning, seen through a stratum of mist.
I reckon we can...
The ridge slope of the Droon's face slammed into the hole, clipping Turgle's arm and sending him sprawling across the floor.
What the fuck?
Anderson was up, but unsteady on his feet as the entire floor tilted. Mucal acid bubbled and fountained through the gap, but the monster could not turn its aim enough to eject the substance directly at Turgle. He rolled across the tilted floor towards Anderson, and they both backed up against the wall.
That was too close, said Turgle.
Anderson just gave him a dirty look. That's not how I like to wake up.
Try finding a different profession, then, Turgle replied.
Their metal shelter crashed back down as the Droon rapidly withdrew its head. The two kept edging back along the inside wall, trying to keep out of spitting range. The creature now began crashing against the object they were in, shifting it, then lifting it from the side they were crouching on. When it thumped down a second time, they both lost their footing. Turgle saw one of the coffin shapes spring open its door. A black-bearded man, wearing a one-piece loose garment of cloth, staggered out.
Over here!
Anderson yelled as he clambered to his feet again. The man looked bewildered, but as the Droon tried to shove its head inside again, he moved very quickly to join them. Almost like someone used to such situations, Turgle thought.
Right. Big monster trying to get in. That figures.
The stranger shook his head at the madness of it all.
My name's Patron Thorn, by the way, he added.
Anderson Indrik of Rondur,
said the knight, eyeing the Droon's head as it once again withdrew. Turgle started laughing, then abruptly choked that off when he sensed the hysteria in it.
"Anyone like to fill me in on what's happening?" Thorn asked smoothly. "I've been in the dark for a while."
He winced.
"I think your first statement already covered the situation," said Turgle.
Just then a section of inner wall beside the gap began smoking, filling the room with an acrid metallic stink.
"Have you got any nicely high-tech weapons in here?" Anderson asked.
Thorn shrugged.
"Not a thing."
"I'm only asking because I think our friend there is going to be in here with us very soon," said Anderson.
The Droon crashed its visage into the hole again, then slammed it from side to side, enlarging the gap in the weakening metal.
"Just a couple more like that should do it," Anderson added grimly.
But then, strangely, everything became still, and all the three of them could hear was the hiss of the acid dissolving metal.
"Perhaps it's given up,"
suggested Turgle, not believing that for a moment. Both Anderson and Thorn gave him a doubtful look. Protracted minutes slunk by, then, as one, they flinched, when something else appeared at the hole. Turgle stared at the woman, her white hair tied back, a sun-browned face with wrinkles at the corners of mild brown eyes. I suggest you get out of there right now, and that we all be prepared to run very fast, she said. My holocaptures aren't going to keep that thing interested for much longer.
Gant's voice, but not Gant speaking.
His breath choked off and vision blurring, Cormac saw the dead soldier bring up the ugly Ceramol commando knife he favoured and swipe it across, felt his AG harness fall away.
Too slow, he realised, as he mentally groped to initiate shuriken.
The throwing star shot viciously from its holster just as Gant threw him hard against the ground. Cormac bounced, consciousness ebbing, but not allowed to go by the perceptile program he pulled from his gridlink. He rolled and came up, levelling his thin gun, as shuriken dropped between himself and Gant, chain-glass blades fully extended, keening high as it spun faster and faster. Now Cormac noticed that on Gant's bare metal chest was some black, tangled growth, as if someone had thrown a wad of glue-soaked human hair at the soldier. Without much hope of a reaction, and without taking his eyes off Gant, Cormac growled, "Come on, show yourself, hero."
"Oh, I'm just a spectator, agent," Skellor replied.
Prompted by his own hearing and the sound pickup in shuriken, Cormac swung round, locating the source of that voice with a triangulation program in his skull's hardware. Shuriken shot sideways with an air-rending shriek and cut through those precise coordinates. At that moment, Gant lunged horrifically fast. With minimum exertion, Cormac turned balletically, pumping 5 shots into a golem knee, so that Gant momentarily lost his balance as he tried to correct his lunge. Stepping back with that attempted correction, Cormac fired twice more, turned and stepped away. Crouching, 2 smoking hollows where his artificial eyes had been, Gant spun towards him, then froze.
"I just thought I'd pause things here," said Skellor from behind Cormac, "to let you know that from where my voice issues will tell you only where I'm not, and maybe not even that."
Shuriken screamed over Cormac's shoulder, cutting to the source of that voice.
"Missed again. But you'd better watch out, as I don't think your friend will."
This time the voice came from far to Cormac's right, and he realized it was time for more drastic action if he was to survive. Gant was now swinging his head from side to side, zeroing in on the beating of Cormac's heart. The agent doubted the soldier would be so easily fooled again. Reluctantly, Cormac made the same decision about Gant as he had made about the landing craft. Shuriken screamed in as Gant straightened and went through his neck with a sound like an axe cleaving tin plate. Something ricocheted off a nearby rock with a bell-like ringing sound, then wickered through the air to land on the ground to Cormac's right. He realized it was a piece of one of Shuriken's extensible chain-glass blades. The star itself then slowly flew away with a pronounced wobble. Gant's head thudded to the ground and his hands battered about his shoulders and severed neck as if looking for it. Whining up to speed again, Shuriken hammered in and took away Gant's leg at the thigh. More chain-glass shrapnel shot in every direction. The soldier toppled over. Then, as the star drew away in preparation for another strike, Gant grew suddenly still, and Cormac cancelled the order.
"You are just no fun at all."
Like a bee undecided about which flower it wanted, Shuriken whined over towards this auditory source. Though Cormac was sure Skellor would not make the mistake of speaking without translocating his voice through his chameleon ware, there was always the chance he might just find himself standing in the wrong place as Shuriken moved about.
"I bet just like any normal grunt. You somehow believe you're going to survive.
Directly in front, over the fallen Gant, the sound Shuriken made was almost a frustration. Frantically, Cormac transmitted a recall order to his location, but not to Shuriken. Then he quickly built other programs in his grid link, covering as many eventualities as he could manage in the little time remaining to him. He knew what kind of subversion would come, had seen it. He began transferring consciousness to his grid link, creating a schizoid division, a partition, unknowingly choosing the same route to survival as a certain large brass golem.
"Well, I'm glad to tell you that you will survive for a very long time."
To the left, above those rocks, Shuriken was a hornet looking for someone to sting.
"But you'll wish you'd died."
A cold breath in Cormac's right ear, then something febrile against his skull just behind it, things moving like a handful of mobile twigs, then the leaden, horrible agony of something boring into his skull. Reaper appeared first, high as the sky, and with a skull occupying his cowl this time. When King appeared directly before Jack, and of equivalent size to him, Reaper shrank down to size as well, milky flesh clothing the skull and blue eyes expanding in its sockets.
"Would you allow Skeller to board you? He would enslave you in moments. And any technology he passed on to you would probably be tainted. So why are you doing this?" Jack asked.
"For how far does our user disturb underspace?" asked King. "It's not possible for us to actually see, but theoretically its influence is definite within a sphere of 200 light years, and possibly some beyond that, which means we have 100 years minimum before any polity ships can get here."
100 years to learn how to control him, or to study him.
"To watch him die," said Reaper.
Jack knew he was missing some undercurrent here.
"Though we may," King continued, "provide him with a way out and go with him to somewhere much more remote. We know where the holes in the line are."
"I will not be his way out," said Jack. "I'll not allow him to use me."
"No, unfortunately not," said King. "But there is the colony ship in orbit that will serve that purpose."
Showing no reaction, either at this virtual level or at any other detectable level, Jack noted the increased traffic down the comm laser and knew that those two, his erstwhile children and allies, were trying something.
"He will die?" Jack asked.
"Everything does," said Reaper, perfectly, if inappropriately, in character.
"His mortality is the immortality of life," added King cryptically.
Jack knew that what they were hinting at could have been said outright, but that they were only drawing this out to give themselves time to get through the communication link, whatever it was they were sending. Probably some nasty virus, worm, or homicidal program. Jack began analysing the data flow and soon saw where the extra stuff was peeling away and creating for itself storage for its various packages, and he considered breaking the link before whatever it was achieved completion. Then a whisper came through to him from his very own ghost.
"Let me."
Releasing his hold on her, Jack saw her drawing those packages towards herself,
and noticed the visual effect, in this particular reality, building like a storm on the horizon. For a fractional second, he wondered why she was risking bringing it together here. Then, with a kind of glee, he realized what she was doing. Reaper and King maybe had not yet learned the caution that when you set a rabid dog on someone, you make sure it has no way of coming back at you.
"The immortality of mortal life is that of its genes," he said, noting through exterior sensors that he was only hours away from entering the Jovian system and a planned final atmospheric deceleration, with possibly fatal consequences.
"Precisely," said King.
"Jane technology propagates itself in an uncontrolled manner, consuming everything in its path while it possesses the energy to do so. This we have learned. His piece of it, Skellor controls through a crystal matrix AI, creating a synergetic balance between the three elements, himself, it, and the AI. They have in fact become one. If any of us tried to insert ourselves into the equation, they would destroy us. If we tried to supplant either the AI or the human part of Skellor, the other parts would totally subjugate us, turning us into a copy of what we supplanted. There is no way in. All we can do is peel away small pieces of this technology and study them.
Then our blocking worked, and you didn't receive the update of Jerusalem's research or his warning about certain treacherous AI elements," said King.
Jack made no immediate reply. He couldn't help but notice how Reaper seemed to have adopted the role of taciturn heavy and King, the smart Alec villain, just as he couldn't help but notice the gathering storm, gelling into an immense Ouroboros, turning like a wheel against the blue sky behind them. King held out a scroll that suddenly appeared in his hand.
"You can now read the update, though we'll keep back the bit about traitors."
Making no attempt to reach for the scroll, either at this VR level or at the informational level on which it had truly been offered, Jack said,
"So there are more of you. Is Sword in on this?"
King became as reticent as Reaper, still waiting for Jack to take the scroll. On a deeper level, Jack recognized the ersatz signature of Jerusalem on the information package offered to him, a four-dimensional Ouroboros. Only this one, he suspected, was waiting to pull its tail out of its mouth so it could bite him very hard. But Afrin had this particular snake in a cleft stick. He reached out and took the scroll. Then all sorts of things happened at once. On the VR level, the giant Ouroboros turned sideways and came thundering towards them, still rolling, perpetually swallowing its own tail, but its giant fanged reptilian head still poised just above the ground. On another level, all those packages Afrin had collected messaged each other and opened at once, creating a chain of viral killers. The front killer of this chain took the brunt of any attack, whilst the next one created a solution to that attack. The last killer in the chain was always in the process of creating another like itself, potentially endless. Ouroboros, indeed.
As he followed the other two out of the ejected VR chamber, Thorn was having difficulties in coming to terms with this reality. The objective time he had spent killing and dying in the dark, he did not know, but the subjective time was many days. Consequently, it was difficult for him actually to adjust to seeing things. Colours were bright acid,
angles and depths seemed dangerous. The two ahead of him also looked like refugees from some pre-runcible hollow history, which did nothing to assist Thorne's grasp on reality. And when he finally stuck his head out of the still-smoking and bubbling hole in the side of the VR chamber, the sight that met his eyes further loosened his grip. A hostile alien had been trying to break in. This much had been evident to Thorne, even in his confused state. Here, though, was a crowd that might send even Lucifer's minions running for cover. Enormous, segmented, insectile horrors, seemingly carved of obsidian or bright chemical yellow crystal sulphur, romped about on the dusty plain. Amid them towered the creature that had been attacking the VR chamber. It was the only one possessing that strange ziggurat head unadorned with pincers, saws, or other lethal appendages. It was going berserk, spitting streams of volatile liquid at the other creatures, thrashing at them with its tail, attempting to snatch them up. Yet its attacks seemed to be having no effect whatsoever. Thorne eventually realized that the larger creature was attacking holograms. "Hollow capture, you said?" He glanced at the woman before dropping from the rim of the hole. Then he scraped burning mucus from his boot heel into the dust. "Yes, but not for much longer. We have to go now." "Go where?" asked the one who seemed to be wearing some primitive version of space armour. The woman pointed to the shimmer of a hard field wall some 100 meters distant. "Dragon will turn it off as we reach it, then back on once we're on the other side." "Dragon?" Thorne eyed her. "Would you rather stay out here?" Thorne glanced at the rampaging monster and the illusions it sought to kill. Already some of them were becoming translucent and displaying reference grid lines inside themselves. "Our stuff!" protested the younger of the two men. "Most of it was on Stone and Bonehead when they bolted," said the elder. "Let's go." After glancing down at the cylinder of the ancient holocapture device she carried, the woman abruptly broke into a trot. The two men, glancing over towards the monster circus, were quick to hurry after her. Thorne was unsurprised to see that some of the images had blinked out. An antiquated device like that would take them out one at a time as its power faded. Hurrying after the others, he glanced both ways along the length of the hard field and hoped Dragon did not intend to display some of its macabre humour by leaving the wall switched on. The monster, once the last image of its monstrous prey vanished, was not likely to be in the best of tempers. He then noted in the distance the familiar shape of a telefactor, lifting off a strew of boulders and quickly heading away, even using a brief fusion burn, which was odd, because in such straits he could see no reason why Jack would want to recall such an easily dispensable device. Just as they reached the shimmering wall, the creature emitted a sound like an air horn in a cave. The woman held up her hand and caught something glassy in it, just as the wall dispersed in silvered autumn. Glancing back once, Thorne observed the monster hammering towards them. No point in running once they had crossed this barrier, for without the wall they were dead for certain, and with it there would be no reason for haste. He didn't look back again. None of them did. Perhaps they all thought it might break some spell. A dull thrumming sound was all that told them the drone had run straight into the replaced barrier. Finally, it was okay for them to look round. They saw the monster, weird and terrifying, marching back and forth behind still wavering energy distortions. To Thorne it briefly occurred that he might still be in VR, but that would not change his present behaviour. Virtual pain hurt just as keenly. Time seemed to slow, as if to give Cormac an appreciation of what was happening to him. He brought his hand up to the side of his head, but in the eternal second it took him to do so, the org creature had established a direct causal link between the proximity of his hand to itself and the amount of pain it allowed him to feel. Pulling the thing away from his head would be more difficult for him than sawing off his own hand. However, coldly, his secondary awareness, established in his grid link, knew all about that. It counted milliseconds and calculated trajectories. It would be a close-run thing, for already Jane fibers were beginning to invade the gridlink itself. Shuriken, hanging in the air, whining like an abandoned pet, abruptly dropped to the dust. There was no longer room for that channel. Cormac must turn all to one purpose. Skellor, the toe of his boot coming down on the Tenkian weapon, started to appear from that point upwards.
"That's one for me," he grinned at Cormac. "You can't fight it for much longer, agent."
Cormac kept his eyes on Skellor's face and elements of his mind out of the man's grasp. "Can you keep a secret?" he asked himself. Slack seconds accumulated, and locking his hands together, he raised his arms above his head and tensed. Immediately a reaction bored through from Skellor. The man did not like this, wanted Cormac to lower his arms.
"See you around,"
Cormac managed through gritted teeth, just as a shadow swept across and the telefactor reached down with clawed grips, grasped Cormac's arms and hauled him into the sky.
"You will crawl back to me,"
Skellor shouted after him. The program Cormac had created and transmitted followed through. As the telefactor rose out of the canyon and flew above the sandstone buttes, it extruded a three-fingered plant sampler with a chain-glass vibroblade. The three chrome fingers closed on the squirming org creature as in a foam of blood and mucus it settled closer against Cormac's head. It then pulled the creature out, stretching the pink tubules that penetrated flesh and bone. The vibroblade extruded, turned like a clock hand, cut the creature away, and the telefactor discarded it. Cormac did not see it fall.